Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Megan Daum's new book is called The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Now, the title might make you think she's a Fox News regular decrying the war against Christmas, but Daum is anything but that. She is a self-proclaimed liberal feminist. And while her book is a sharp critique of what she sees as the social media-driven excesses of liberal feminism and identity politics, it's also something else. A woman approaching midlife, maybe waving her Gen X fist at millennials to get off her lawn? Okay, so I jest there because there's always going to be intergenerational friction. But Daum laments something more than that, something deeper. She laments the death of subtlety and how politics and technology now, in her words, deny human beings the right to be complicated. That, she says, is the problem. So this hour on Point, Megan Daum on The Problem with Everything. And you can join us from campus politics to the Me Too movement to identity politics or even the current president. What's your reaction to what Megan Daum says are the excesses of identity politics and her pushback against, for example, purity policing, as she calls it? Join us online at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Megan Daum joins us today from New York. Again, the name of her new book is The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Welcome to On Point, Megan.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So take us back to 2016. What did you hope to write then?
It seems so long ago now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, around 2015, 2016, I started noticing something going on, especially in social media circles, not entirely, but, you know, predominantly. And that was a lot of the discussion around women's issues, feminism, third wave, fourth wave, whatever you want to call it, feminism, really was premised on this notion that women were like this monolithic oppressed class. There was a lot of talk about toxic masculinity. There were some hashtags that were, you know, meant to be ironic, hashtag ban men, kill all men, that sort of thing. And, you know, I saw that it was there, the tone of it was in jest, but I thought it was paradoxical because this was happening at a time when women had really never been doing better in the history of civilization. We were surpassing men in most spheres, not all, but most. And so I wanted to look at why there was this paradox and sort of examine my own conflicted feelings about it. But then something happened,
in?
I think, as you know.
Yeah, so indeed. Let me just jump in here, though, because I might do this quite a bit during this hour, and you're going to have to forgive me in advance, because your book really is this thoughtful provocation about what it means to have a culture in which subtlety is flattened down to nothing, right? And
yes.
If, you know, in hearing you say, like, you know, women were doing better than ever in just before 2016 and surpassing men in most areas, and you threw in the not all, I mean, isn't that an example in and of itself of how we've squashed subtlety out of everything? Because I think, you know, you and I, just right now, we could brainstorm a lot of ways in which women were not and are not doing better than men still in 2019.
We can brainstorm, and we would be right in a lot of cases. But I think it's really easy for people in our position to focus on people who are the fact that men are most CEOs of major corporations. There are more white men in the corridors of power. That is absolutely true. But in the general scheme of things, women have been doing better than men for a long time. We're better educated. We're much more likely to be valedictorians of high school classes. We go to college, much higher rates. The gender wage gap, which isn't something I get into in great detail in the book, but, you know, that's something that's measurable mostly in terms of motherhood. Is that fair? No. But it's not necessarily the great conspiracy that we usually assume it to be. So I really wanted to really look at this from a wider scope. I mean, I think it's easy to forget that, You know, up until very recently, the idea that women could compete with men in the job market, that men should do housework, that women had any purpose in life higher than having babies was almost unfathomable. So we've really come a very long way in a very short amount of time. And that's not to say that there isn't more work to do, but I think we should be mindful of that.
So generationally, I see your point there. But I do have to just, again, in my support of your call for subtlety and complexity, I will say that, like, for example, when you factor in race and the gender wage gap, there's much progress still to be made on that front here. But okay, so this is why your book is so interesting, right? Because any little thing we could dive in and spend
an argument on any paragraph.
So tell me then, you were really looking at how these things are talked about in social media, which is the interesting part. And then we had the election of 2016. So what changed for you? Why did you step back from your original thesis?
Well, I had conceived of all of this assuming that Hillary Clinton would be the president and that the culture would be sort of more up for a gentle ribbing or critique of the modern state of feminism. And then we know what happened. Trump got elected, and I really had to step back and look at the bigger picture. And really what was happening was that over time, I could see that this memification of feminism, the sort of reducing concepts and slogans into hashtags, this sort of thing, that was becoming an aspect of a much larger problem, which was the deterioration of public thought. So, you know, I was as horrified as anyone by the Trump election. I cannot stand Donald Trump. I would vote for a fire hydrant to get him out of office. But, you know, one of the things that's happened is that the trauma of the Trump election has, in many ways, caused much of the political left to declare like a state of emergency in which any utterance that could possibly be construed as complicated or supporting the other side in any way is deemed off limits. And that has created a chokehold on cultural conversation, no matter what we're talking about. And that's really what the book became about.
So tell me more about why this state of emergency, as expressed especially by young people on the left, you found or find problematic when we have a similar state of emergency or, extreme communications of a state of emergency that having come from the right for a long time.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, when you talk about identity politics, that's something that the right created. I mean, Donald Trump is all about identity politics. It takes a different form. You know, one of the things, this is so obvious, but I think it's worth saying and thinking about a lot. We talk in tweets now and in memes, and the president communicates in tweets, and political movements and social causes have been reduced to hashtags. So we have this discourse that rewards simplistic, reductive messaging and actually penalizes complexity of thought. And the problem with that is that if you want to talk about how to fix problems, you need to talk about what is true. And anything that is true is intrinsically complicated. And we just don't have a sort of conversational climate right now that can tolerate complication and complexity.
Mm. I mean, you write in the book early on that you found yourself being irritated, quote, by the smug vibe many young activists had within the new left.
I mean, there was a lot of that. And I think that, you know, it's really interesting. I think even in the last couple of months, people are getting really, really tired of this kind of, you know, I call it purity policing. And I actually don't use that. I don't use terms like snowflake and trigger and social justice warrior in earnest ever in this book, because I think that that's kind of the language of the other side. And I think it's dehumanizing and really sort of missing the point in a lot of ways. But I do think that social media has just flattened the discourse and made it very, very difficult, not only for people to get their message across, but even know what their message is, because everything is just communicated in the most simplistic of terms.
Yeah. Just in that same paragraph here, because my eyes have once again fallen on it, you write, "In the spirit of all this, I coined my own term to describe the class of NPR listening, New Yorker reading, Slate podcast downloading elites once called the cognoscenti. They were now the woke-scenti." Megan, welcome to NPR, by the way, here.
I, my favorite place to be. I am part of the woke-scenti. We all are.
You are?
Yeah. I have a Volvo. Let's just put it that way.
Okay, but I mean, but when you write about this, you're picking out certain factors here, and you're not holding this group of people up, you know, on a pedestal. I mean, the whole paragraph is about that smugness.
No, of course. So, you know, what I'm doing here is a self-interrogation. I could have written a book that was really hammering away at a lot of this stuff, what you see going on college campuses in terms of the activism, the cancel culture, the sort of, you know, the way that the Me Too movement has, some would call it going too far. I really think of it more as maybe not being as precise as it should have. I could have just sort of stayed on that and said, well, you know, this is why this is bad. And I, as an older person, am right. And these younger people are wrong. But that is really not what I do as a writer. I wanted to do a self-interrogation. I wanted to look at why there was a gulf between what I was thinking and feeling and what I thought I was supposed to think and feel as a, you know, certainly former, maybe now, you know, a little bit, still got a foot in the woke dissenti. Why is it that there seems to be so much cognitive dissonance? And I think a lot of people are feeling that. And I really then started to look at what was it about my experience growing up in the 70s and the 80s as a Gen Xer that informed me in a way that shaped my sensibility to maybe lead me to this conflicted point.
So we've got about 30 seconds before we have our first break here. But Megan, begin to answer that very interesting question you just asked out loud. Like, the what is driving the gulf between what you are, were thinking and feeling, and what you were, you felt like you were supposed to be thinking and feeling?
So a lot of it has to do with, again, social media.
Yeah.
But I really think that Gen Xers especially need to be more mindful of the great gift that we had of growing up in the 1970s and the 80s. Not just before social media, but before a lot of very sort of pointed binary messages about how to be a person started to take center stage.
Okay, well, we will explore more of that when we come back. We're speaking today with Megan Daum. Her new book is The Problem with Everything: My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Megan Daum. She was a columnist for the LA Times for more than a decade, also a contributor to The New Yorker, The Atlantic, New York Times Magazine as well, and she has a new book out. It's called The Problem with Everything: My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Megan, so just before the break, you were telling us about your thoughts as a Gen X woman, and the difference. In fact, you were saying the sort of special kinds of experiences that Gen Xers had in their upbringing versus maybe what younger generations have. I was wondering if you might be able to actually read a little bit from the book along these lines about the generational problem as you see it.
Absolutely, sure. I can just read a little bit, and I will just quickly set this up saying I'm talking here about sort of issues of mentorship. You know, I do a lot of teaching. I teach graduate students, you know, people in their 20s. And I often find that it's really hard for me to advise them because the world I inhabit professionally, personally, socially is just so much different. The world they inhabit now is so much different than the one I did when I was their age. And so this little passage sort of addresses that. Young people don't want to be us because they're not even the same species as us. Even if they did want to be us, the proposition would be absurd, like a human trying to emulate an orangutan. the world has changed so much between my time and theirs that someone just 10 years younger might as well belong to a different geological epoch. In this epoch, there are no payphones for calling friends at the spur of the moment. The contact highs from walking down the street have been replaced by dopamine hits from Instagram likes. To a young person, someone like me is not so much an elder as an extinction.
That's Megan Daum reading from her new book, The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. So Megan, what are you getting at there? Are you...
It's pretty uplifting, isn't it? Yes, that's not the end. That's the beginning of it. So, you know, one of the theories that I float in this book has this idea, it has to do with this idea of toughness versus fairness. I think there's something about having grown up in the 70s and the 80s. We tended to fetishize toughness and aloofness. A lot of it was about being cool. We wanted to show that we were independent from our parents. We didn't want to show emotion. There was just a sort of spirit around childhood and personhood that made us place a lot of value. And I would argue probably too much value in self-reliance and toughness and being able to take the hits. There was a lot of bullying that went on then. And it's great that that's been phased out, although it's taken on a new form. So I think that one of the things that's happened is the millennials may have a similar sort of overvaluing of fairness and justness. And we might do well to sort of say, okay, well, what are the things that informed us and what are the things that informed them? And maybe we could have a little bit of an exchange. And I also, there are a lot of ideas that that I kind of play around with in this book in terms of extreme gender binary expressions. I mean, there was something about being a kid in the 70s that was really almost androgynous. You know, we weren't boys and girls as much as we were kids. And I think that that experience, maybe more than anything, has shaped our sensibility and the differences that we have around a lot of these issues of sexual consent and just kind of presentation of oneself as a woman and being a woman in the world and the feminist conversation and all of that.
Okay, so everything you say, there's like 10 follow-ups here, Megan.
Yes.
But I want to go backwards about 30 seconds or so. You said that you think that the millennial generation may overvalue things like fairness and justice?
There's a sense of like, well, this is not the notion of a hierarchy in and of itself is something that people don't want to talk about. Like human beings, civilizations are naturally hierarchical. You know, living things in communities are going to have some sort of structure around that. And life is not fair. And one of the things that troubles me is that in order to talk about how to make things more fair, we need to have honest conversations about what makes them not fair and whether or not there's really anything to be done about that. And I have noticed that even starting to ask those questions is almost like terrifying. Like, oh, no, we can't ask that because then that's going to lead us down a path that makes us very uncomfortable. So that's what I mean by that.
Right. Well, so this is a really important avenue of exploration within the context of Me Too, for example, because, you know, in the workplace, there is the existence of power imbalances, right? That's what you're saying is that's a de facto truth about the workplace. Someone is going to be your boss, right? And so therefore, they're going to be more powerful than you in the hierarchical structure of most American workplaces. But I don't think necessarily that Me Too is getting at trying to undermine basic hierarchical power structures, but rather questioning the abuses thereof, don't you think?
Yes and no. I hear from a lot of people that really kind of want to blow up the whole system. And I don't think they necessarily mean that literally, but I'm not sure that they can articulate what it is that they do mean. You know, I'm interested in these ideas like, you know, how do we talk about something like due process when it comes to sexual assault on campus or a Me Too situation in an office? You know, terms like due process in and of themselves have become tripwires. This is what I mean about the conversational chokehold. Mm-hmm. You know, I've noticed even sometimes the word nuance is weaponized. I mean, I've seen people on Twitter sort of, you know, post some sort of article that they don't agree with, and they'll say, oh, another nuanced take, or here's another person banging on about due process. And really that is quite troubling, because, you know, due process is at the heart of our system. It's what makes the country work, you know, as well as it does, which isn't all that well all the time. But I just worry that we're sort of being glib about tossing some of these ideas around and again, not being precise.
Well, let's take a quick call here, because I'll come back to this in a minute, Megan, but we have a lot of callers who want to join us. So let's go to Lisa, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Lisa, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I just wanted to comment on this because this is so close to my heart. And I'm pretty liberal, and my daughters are too. I've got two of them that are 36 and 32. One's in the UK, and we've been talking about this whole situation, and she makes a comment on Twitter or something else, and she's a boomer, because I don't think they understand the difference in the generation. First of all, I think learning all the appropriate terminology seems to be more important than being able to actually have a conversation, you know, by excluding people. They don't want to be judged, but they're being very judgmental, and I think that's what's causing, you know, a lot of this turmoil. Is just people, they really don't understand. It's like they're not learning. You're learning peace and instead of learning how to communicate as a whole. Mm. That seems to be, you know, being that, especially the gender identity is even worse. You know, it's like they're taking away from women's rights. It's like you're not helping them by doing this and saying that everybody's equal, or, you know, men have periods. And I won't go into all that whole thing, but it just makes it very difficult for even young people to be able to, you know what's right or what's wrong. And I feel like they have a difficult time, probably more than I do.
Right. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your call. Megan, do you have a response for Lisa?
Yeah, I mean, we seem to be in this moment where we think that identity is equivalent to ideology. So that if you have certain characteristics, you have certain immutable traits, you identify as a particular race, as ethnicity, gender, whatever it is, that there's going to be a set of political values that comes attached to that. And that is really dehumanizing, actually. You know, we talk about erasing people's humanity, and to me, slicing everybody into thinner and thinner identity categories and automatically assigning a sort of political value system to that is profoundly insulting, frankly. And a lot of that ends up what's expressed on social media. And unfortunately, social media is the main platform for expression.
Hmm. Let's go to Kaylee, who's calling from Ithaca, New York. Kaylee, you're on the air.
Hi, hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. So I just had maybe a question and a comment combined, which is, I'm listening to this conversation and I'm really taken aback with how narrow her point of view is. It seems to really be coming from a white woman of privilege who is accessing information from Twitter and not from being a part of any of these movements. She has a lot of opinions, but not really based on anything factual. So that concerns me. And I wish that she could incorporate some more thought from people of color, more marginalized groups, et cetera, into her point of view, because it's a little too narrow to reach me. So,
well, Kaylee, thank you for your call. And Megan, how would you like to respond to Kaylee?
Well, I am a white woman. I am a privileged white woman. I'm a white feminist. But I am speaking here as a person with a certain sort of, shall we say, bogusness detector. I'm not making these observations just from the point of view as a white person. I'm really looking at where the hypocrisies are in the culture, what we're skirting, the truths that we're avoiding. And in my experience, that's not a white privilege thing. I can tell you all kinds of people across the spectrum of race and class and gender identity. They know this kind of pandering when they see it. They're tired of you know, every other story on an opinion page, you know, sort of wrapping itself in the banner of Me Too, or this kind of diluted version of intersectionality. And I can't tell you how many people from all different places and walks of life are really frustrated by the level of discourse. And that's pretty much how I approached it. And yeah, we've been talking a lot about Twitter in this conversation, but I can tell you there's a lot of reporting. I talk a lot. There's a whole section that takes place in the Midwest on a campus. There's lots of interviews. So yes, I can imagine that from our conversation up to this point, we've been talking a lot about Twitter, but there's much more than that.
Well, I mean, the social media part of this is important because it, even if we're siloed, it's a direct reflection of the kinds of messages that that we hear as increasingly as our primary source of communication between people. I mean, that's one of the problems with everything that you're
yes,
talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I it's really not even a dodge anymore to talk about Twitter. Unfortunately, that is what metabolizes everything. Journalism gets run through Twitter. Everything gets reduced to a certain number of characters. It's really, really frustrating. And, you know, one of the things that I often say to my students is, you know, they go, what did you used to do when you were our age? Like, how did you spend your time? And I thought, you know what? I spent a lot of time, like, staring at the wall and just sort of thinking and staring out the window and, you know, calling my friends on the phone and talking to them for an hour or more and just sort of hashing things out. And there was so much more room in that kind of intellectual space at that time to work through your thoughts, to make intellectual rhetorical errors, to get things wrong, to say, well, hey, what am I missing here? What am I getting wrong here? And that is no longer available. And that's makes me really sad, frankly, for all of us, because it's not, I know I don't stare at the wall and think deep thoughts for hours upon hours anymore either.
Yeah. Look, I'll be perfectly honest. I'm not that different from you in age. And so sometimes there's a lot about modern life that I think this is definitely not how I grew up. But isn't that just par for the course? Is what you're writing about Gen X sort of grappling with the midlife crisis, with entering middle age? You said in the beginning of the book, you said you don't even want to call it a midlife crisis, but you do talk about sort of your personal transition and how that, the changes in your life and how that sort of fueled, you know, why you ended up writing the book in the way you did.
Yes. So I had many versions of this book. I tried it out in all sorts of different ways. And ultimately, it just seemed clear that the best way to do it for me, just artistically, you know, knowing my own sensibility, was to look at it through a personal lens. And frankly, a lot of it was animated through getting divorced. I got very amicably divorced about 4 years ago. And one of the things that I really, really lost when I lost that relationship was my intellectual ally. You know, my husband and I, for all of our problems, we were always on the same page in terms of how we saw the world. And when I lost that, because of the sort of moment we were in digitally, in terms of the media, in terms of the way people were starting to talk to one another or not talk to one another online, I found myself sort of turning to these strange corners of the internet and where I would watch like academics and neuroscientists and scholars talking to each other on YouTube for hours and hours and hours. And so that's what a lot of the book is about. And it talks about that vis-a-vis just my own aging process. And like we said earlier, getting older as a Gen Xer, which is different than maybe than getting older as a baby boomer.
So, but I mean, the people that you were watching, these academics and intellectuals, they're a particular group, right? The John McWhorters and the Jordan Petersons of the world.
Well, it's funny that you say that because I'm not sure I would put John McWhorter and Jordan Peterson in the same category.
Okay,
so I'm
fair
not
enough.
Going to call them a particular group.
Okay, okay.
That's what's funny about this.
Fair
so,
enough.
Yeah, so I got hooked on watching John McWhorter and Glenn Lowry talk to each other on bloggingheads.tv. And they would, they're both African-American men. Glenn Lowry's an economist. John McWhorter's a linguist, a cultural critic, among other things. And they would talk about lots of things, issues of race, but lots of things in this incredibly nuanced and really free-ranging and honest and unparanoid way. And it was so, so refreshing. And it was really noticeable how much different the experience of listening to them talk was in listening even to, like, people talking on the radio. So much had changed just in terms of the attention span and the sort of intellectual bandwidth of the culture.
But the fact that you were able to access that dialogue between those two through YouTube, if we're talking about complexity and nuance, that's part of the bigger picture. I mean, we can trash Twitter all we want, but at the same time, you can watch an hour-long debate between two intellectuals being as nuanced as ever.
But those intellectuals are liberals who have now been relabeled conservatives, and that's troubling.
All right. Well, Megan Dumm, her new book is The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Megan Dumm. Her new book is The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. And we're getting messages or some feedback here, Megan, through Facebook and Twitter. But Jackie Kelly says on Twitter, listening to you on the radio, she's talking to you, Megan, I just wanted to say thank you for voicing everything I'm thinking and bringing it into the light. Many people have lost their way in reality, and you bring it back to perspective. Over on Facebook, Kevin Kennedy says, at a time when people are getting screamed at for just speaking Spanish in public, when blacks are harassed, arrested, or worse for just going about their lives, when the president calls for American politicians who criticize him to be sent back to where they come from, it seems as if the United States has more serious problems than political correctness right now. I wonder what you think about that, Megan, about what Kevin wrote.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. I think, you know, it's true that we are in an emergency. It's really scary what's going on. It's really upsetting. People are justified in their rage and their fear. And I think for that very reason, it has never been more important for the left to have a coherent message and a message that is inclusive, that isn't sort of dwelling in these kind of fringe corners of social media. And it's easy to sort of say, oh, well, that's not really true. That's not really happening. But, you know, you've got candidates, you know, Democratic presidential candidates who are really pandering to a very, very small segment of the population. I mean, you know, it's like something like, you know, the New York Times will use the term Latinx, for instance, which is the sort of plural non-binary term for Latinos. And there was recently a poll done, like 98% of Latinos don't want to have that term used. They want to be called Hispanics. I think we're sort of operating under this illusion that sort of channeling this, you know, almost making a trend out of progressive politics is going to be useful. And I just fear that it's going to backfire. And the stakes are really high, as that Facebook poster pointed out.
Are we in a moment, though, which I suppose if you look back in history, we might see at various times that when there is a surge of new voices and new perspectives that are finally heard because they reach a certain age or they they have a certain demographic weight behind them, that you know, it's new voices and new perspectives. And for those who had been previously heard, that it might feel, you know, a little uncomfortable. I guess what I'm saying is that does the system sort of naturally correct itself? Does the pendulum swing back a little bit, but to a more inclusive overall place?
I think it will, and I hope it will, but we really need to grant all these new conversations and the people who haven't been heard before, who are coming out more, we need to grant them a full hearing. We need to be able to ask questions. You know, getting back to the trans issue, and this is not something I actually talk about in the book that much, but since a caller brought it up, you know, and it's to your point, a lot of people who care deeply about transgender rights, people who have trans family members, parents of trans kids, are not even allowed to ask certain questions because it's been decided that asking questions equals being skeptical, and being skeptical equals not being supportive, and that constitutes harm. And that is the definition of a bad faith position. It's what keeps people in the dark and confused and without information. And it's from the darkness and confusion that harm is done to people. And I just think that is a line of logic we ignore at our peril.
Right. Well, so a different example of how in a sort of spasm of reaction, we may actually end up in a more thoughtful place. I'll offer the example of that Aziz Ansari story from 2018 now, from early 2018 that happened.
Yes. Doesn't it seem much longer ago than that? So much time has passed.
Yeah. So for folks who don't remember or didn't read it or have excised it from their memory. So back in early 2018 on a website, I think now defunct, called babe.net, there was an article featuring the personal experiences of a woman named Grace who had been on a date with Aziz Ansari, the actor and comedian. And the date didn't go as she wanted. She said it was the worst night of her life. Lots of detail about their sexual interactions there. But there was no, I mean, she didn't accuse him of doing anything that would constitute sexual assault, but that he didn't read her cues, right? He wasn't responsive to her. But this thing like really blew up, and you spend some time writing about it in the book. Why? Tell us about what you think is important about this story.
Well, it was the moment when the generational divide just became so obvious. Younger women were saying, "Oh, this is unacceptable. He needs to be held into account for his behavior. This is an example of toxic masculinity, the patriarchy. We need to teach men not to do this, et cetera, et cetera." And then older women, baby boomers, Gen Xers like me, were kind of like, "Hey, don't you know how to call a cab? Like, you know, what's going on here? Have some agency. Take responsibility for yourself. You know, it's this whole sort of, you know, if he gets handsy, hit him over the head with your stiletto, like this kind of thing." And again, as in so much of the book, I didn't really want to say like one side's right, the other side's wrong, but I wanted to look at where this division came from. And again, I think that people my age grew up with very different conditions when it came to sexual encounters, issues of consent. I think the ubiquity of online pornography is no small thing when it comes to shaping the expectations of young men and women and everybody in you know, younger generations. And so that's an example when I think, you know, it's easy to sort of say, "Hey, Grace, pull your act together." But it's more complicated than that. And again, we need to be able to talk about that rather than just yell at each other and, you know, one person called somebody a snowflake and the other side called them an internalized misogynist. You know, that's just not useful.
Yeah. I mean, look, when that story came out, I think it was a good example of how in the first set of responses, there was little to no subtlety, no nuance at all. And when you started, I mean, the journalistic malpractice within the story itself was hugely problematic. But when you start digging into even how the website babe.net, I mean, it was run by a guy who had sites in the UK and their outlets regularly ran rear of the year competitions, you know, pictures of women's backsides. And the website was funded by Rupert Murdoch. I mean, there was a whole sort of just being manipulated by the media machine part of this that I really had an objection to. That's a sidebar here. But the reason why I wanted to ask you about the Ansari thing is because you know, recently in his Netflix special, Aziz Ansari himself talked about that article in a really interesting way. And I just wanted to play a moment from it. And you'll hear him. He begins his stand-up special and he addresses the allegations that were made against him in that article.
I just felt terrible that this person felt this way. And after a year or so, I just hope it was a step forward. It moved things forward for me, made me think about it a lot. I hope I become a better person. And I always think about a conversation I had with one of my friends where he was like, you know what, man? That whole thing made me think about every date I've ever been on. And I thought, wow, well, that's pretty incredible. This made not just me, but other people be more thoughtful, then that's a good thing. And that's how I feel about it.
So Megan Dom, Aziz Ansari also says in that stand-up special that the year he spent in 2018, he felt like he had died, right? Because he hardly performed. He couldn't talk about this at all. It was like he had a sense that this would be what it would be like if I died. But he also says, as you just heard, that ultimately, if it made people more thoughtful, he thinks it's a good thing. So how do you, I mean, that's nuanced.
That's magnanimous of him. I thought he threaded the needle there really well. I thought, I saw that special. I thought it was excellent. I didn't think it was especially funny, but it was certainly thoughtful. And I thought he pulled it off as well as he could have. You know, this stuff is so new. Me Too is in its infancy, you know? It can be. It's good sometimes, it's bad sometimes, it's not any one thing. And personally, I don't think that anything that happens between consenting adults, regardless of power differentials, should be enough to get somebody canceled or fired or feel like they're dead. I mean, well, in some cases, it can be a reason for somebody to lose their job if there are certain, you know, violations that have occurred, certain policies that have been violated. But, you know, we need to stop letting a relatively small number of people with outsized influence on social media decide who gets to stay and who has to leave. It just seems like there's a bullying effect. And a lot of institutions are ceding authority to a very small number of people on social media. And I'm glad that Aziz Ansari pulled out of it. But not everybody has those kinds of rhetorical skills, the kind of leverage, the kind of is in a position to come back like that.
Well, let's go to Lacey, who's calling from Taylorville, Illinois. Lacey, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Just kind of what you were talking about a very minority of people that are kind of getting most of the voice in the conversation. I'm a Generation Xer myself. My children are millennials. And they came to me kind of talking about feminism one day. And I guess I haven't really talked to them a whole bunch about it. But from their point of view, a feminist was somebody who wanted all men to die or be subjugated or never to have any rights. And I had to explain to them, because they get their point of view completely from social media, from Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, that it's not the moderates that you hear online. It's the most extreme voices. A lot of that has to do with just the way that the internet is set up, to where whatever's going to get the most reaction is what is, what is put up to the forefront, what people see first. So you have like the most extreme point of view speaking the loudest, and I had to sit down with him and be like, that's not what real feminism is. Most actual feminists do not think that men should be subjugated or they should all die or anything like that. And it took a while to convince him of this, that was like a 1% point of view that they were hearing, and that wasn't everybody. That everybody doesn't agree with what they hear.
Yeah. Lacey, I'm going to take it back from you since we're running down on time here, but thank you so much for your call. Megan, at least Lacey was able to have that conversation with her millennial kids, as she says.
Yeah. So much of this is people crave affiliation. They want to belong to a group, you know. They want to know that they're part of a larger community. And so often that community is rooted in having certain assumptions that really have to do with slogans and not reality. I mean, I guess I would say to people, you know, before you tweet something or before you get on your soapbox, ask yourself, are you fulfilling some kind of moral obligation, really? Are you fighting the fight? Or are you just self-soothing, you know? Like, are you feeding your narcissism? And, you know, we all have narcissism, but it's in such high relief today in today's social climate that it's really distorting the message. I think that's what this caller articulated perfectly. Like, feminism is important, you know, human rights are important, equality is important, inclusion is important. And to just diminish it to statistical slogans that you know, misrepresent the facts. Is in fact disrespectful to the human project and to human rights and people living good lives.
Mm. But this is true of wherever you are on the political spectrum. And we've been focusing on the left, but it's true everywhere.
Yes. You know, again, I can't emphasize this enough. You know, an identity is not an ideology. Like, you know, we contain multitudes. Like, just because I'm a feminist doesn't mean I'm in lockstep with the sanctioned positions of contemporary feminism. There are gay Republicans out there. I'm willing to bet there are lots of transgender and even non-binary people out there who don't know and don't care about the battles we're seeing over pronouns, how to finally slice these identity categories. The vast majority of people are just out there living their lives. And I dare say life works better when you're actually living it than constantly trying to define it and certainly trying to perform it.
Well, let's see if we can sneak one more call in here. Mark is calling from Winslow, Maine. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Megan. I love the title of your book, Problem with Everything, Feminism, Cancel Culture, and the Internet. I see that there is a serious problem with inclusivity in this country with race and gender, and a small number of people are in power with social media, entertainment, business, politics. President Trump, a great example, and I suggest that it is the cult of personality over generations that we need to get away from. I would love your input.
Mark, thank you for your call, but let me just fact check something. The official subtitle of Megan's book is My Journey Through the New Culture Wars, but go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with anything you say. You know, the cult of personality has always dominated the culture. You know, politicians, people don't get into politics because they want to have, like, you know, really nuanced conversations and kind of chew things over. Those sorts of people get into academia, although not so much anymore. Again, I'm really hoping that we're just in a sort of transitional phase with all of this. I can tell you, in talking about this book, even just in the last month being out there talking about this book, people are hungry for nuance. They just want to have conversations that allow for conflict. And I guess if anything, I want people to remember that it's okay to feel conflicted. It's become really uncomfortable for people to sit in their conflict or to not feel totally aligned with their peers or one particular group. You know, having criticisms and asking questions about your long-held truths and assumptions doesn't make you a traitor to the cause, right? Mm-hmm. It actually means you care enough about the cause to want to hold it into account.
Well, you end the book with this really interesting thought. You write, "I realize now that much of what I've been reacting to these last few years is nothing more than undeveloped versions of already undeveloped thoughts." We've got about 30 seconds left to go, Megan. Why was that an important realization for you?
Well, think of all the stupid, silly things that we said when we were, like, you know, in middle school, right? It's not fair to have your stupidest utterings broadcast to the world and then taken seriously. I think we all owe ourselves the gift and the space to work out our thoughts give our complexities their due and be generous to ourselves and to others.
Yeah, to be human is to be complex. And in fact, I mean, I think a common phrase in this day, which I would agree with, is it's complicated. So are we all.
That's right. And that's not a dodge, by the way. That's the truth.
Well, Megan Dalm's new book is The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Megan, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.